Welcome. The clock says 11. Thank you for coming today. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. It's my pleasure to introduce Dan Spencer, Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Montana, and he's leading the discussion today on Earth Ethics 2, Placing Ourself in the Debate. Thank you, Dan. We're not miking Dan. He has a great projectable voice, and everyone can hear. But as a reminder, if you're offering comments, make sure that you're speaking loud enough for everyone to hear and remind each other if that is not the case. So thank you, Dan.
Thanks so much, Sharon. Thanks for those of you who are coming back. And how many folks are here for the first time? Weren't here yesterday. So we got quite a few. And so
weren't here.
We're not here yesterday. We have quite a few, so I'm going to do a little recap on where we were. I have employed my sister Martha as a teaching assistant. She also has a Spencer voice that can project. I think the mics are in use right now with the board meetings, which is fine. But if anybody does have problems hearing, let me know. Or if you didn't hear a comment that somebody made or a question they asked, let me know, and I will be happy to try to repeat that. I also have some hearing challenges. My left ear is kind of closed off, so particularly on this side of the room, if I don't hear you initially, be persistent on that. So this is a session, or a week series, that is drawn from a book that I wrote with a couple friends of mine called Earth Ethics. My co-authors are Jim Martin Schramm and Laura Stivers, who both have a long history at Holden as well. So in many ways, the origins of this book come from a lot of discussions at Holden. All three of us also teach ethics at the college or university level. Jim is at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. I'm at the University of Montana in the Environmental Studies program, and Laura's at Dominican University in the Northern Bay Area of California. So we've been trying to find ways to talk about ethical issues that are interactive and involve people in here, and that's what I've done today. So if you don't want to be interacting, these are probably not the best week for you to be coming to sessions, because I'm going to be drawing on you continuously. What we did yesterday and we're going to continue it today is to do some broad framing exercise to think broadly about different ways of thinking about ethical issues that involve the environment or ecology or ecological crisis. And then starting on Wednesday, starting tomorrow, we'll look at three different cases that are all contemporary, current cases, they're actual cases, which will involve you in having to make some decision choices about issues. One of them, the one tomorrow, is one called Maybe One. It looks at a young couple that's deciding whether or not to start a family, and if so, how many children they should have. And it looks at the impact of human population growth, our levels of consumption, and climate change issues around that. On Thursday, we'll be looking at the impact of food choices we make. There's a case called Moral Eating. It's centered initially around whether or not we should raise and eat animals as part of our diet, but thinking about a broad range of issues, including the well-being of the animals themselves, the contribution of meat-based diets to climate change and other environmental issues. So we'll be taking a look at that. And then on Wednesday, on Friday, and we had a member, I don't know if she's here today, it was Dorothy from Texas, right over here, who brought up the issue of water and endangered species. How in the West, where we increasingly have water shortages, increasing challenges of drought, but there are a lot of species besides humans who need the water here. How do we balance human needs and demands on water with endangered species? And we'll look at that, particularly in the Klamath Basin of Southern Oregon and Northern California. So that's sort of where we're heading. Let me just see if there's any questions, comments, or concerns on where we are, where we've been, or where we're headed. Yes?
All these things you just talked about, is that summarized in this book you talked about?
Yeah, so this book, and unfortunately, I thought there was a copy in the library, but I don't think there is. What this book is, it has three introductory chapters that do the kind of the broad framing issues that we're going to be doing today, and they are called The Context for Earth Ethics, What's Our Current Context Here? And again, just a reminder, for those who weren't here yesterday, we termed this term Earth Ethics rather than Environmental Ethics because we wanted to think about the Earth itself as our community. Environment is a term we use a lot, and every organism has an environment. Every organism lives in an environment, so fish live in an aquatic environment, birds may live in an aerial environment. But environment tends to be external to us, and we tend to think about it as the resources we need, whereas Earth as our community involves us interacting with a wide array of creatures, both human and more than human creatures on that. And so that's what we're terming it Earth Ethics. And so this book sets up the how to think about that in those terms there. First is the context, second is perspectives. And that's what we're doing, and I'll remind us of where we were yesterday and where we're going to start today. And the third one is some resources or how to think about that. And then it goes through 9 cases. And each of the cases has a short 3 or 4 page description of the case and then a longer commentary. What I have here, which I'm going to hand out at the end there, I have about 30 of these, so you're going to have to go for about one of every other people. So if you're here with somebody else, if you can share with them, there are also 5 copies on reserve in the library. But I have the short descriptions of the case for the one we're doing tomorrow called Maybe One, on Population, Consumption, Climate Change. I'm hoping people can read that. It should take you about 10 minutes or so to read through it. Because you'll see there's a variety of different perspectives related, and I'm going to set up a scenario where we're going to have those perspectives engage each other. For anybody who wants to read the case and the commentary, I have 5 copies of both the case and the commentary in the library. So if you want to read the analysis ahead of time, we'll be doing that analysis together. But some of you might find it interesting to read ahead of time. If you want that, that's in the library for each of the 3 cases we're doing here. So that's sort of where we're headed on that. And so thank you for that. Any other comments, questions, concerns you want to address here? Oh, yes, teaching assistant.
He won't tell you, but there are copies of his book in the bookstore.
Oh, is it there?
Yeah.
So, thank you, teaching assistant. Somebody was asking about it, and I didn't think there were. Yeah. Is there more than one?
Well, I only saw one, but there may be more in the back.
What I'm wondering
so
is...
So run!
Maybe I'll check with the library and see if we can get one on copy, borrow the one from the bookstore just to put it on in the library. There's people just want to... I'm not trying to promote the book, although I do think it's really good. It's, this is the dilemma that every teacher has. We get frustrated with the texts that are out there, so we write our own textbook for our classes there, and then we think everybody else is going to love it, which doesn't always happen. But I did get to teach this book for the first time in the Environmental Studies program and in the Honors College, and Rebecca here in the front row is a graduate of both of those, the Davidson Honors College and the Environmental Studies program, this spring in a seminar, and it was really fun and engaging. So that's what made me think it might be fun to try these cases out up here. We're talking the broad principles today. We saw yesterday in the spectrum exercises, we're going to do one more of those, how challenging it can be to think about these broad principles and where you fit yourself on that. When we actually get to the cases, then you're going to have to say, okay, now what do I actually think in this particular case? If I put myself in this case, how would I respond to that? So let me just go a little review of where we were yesterday, and that will lead us into the first thing. I want to try and do 2, possibly 3 more of these interactive discussions here that we did yesterday. And for those of you who weren't here, you'll see pretty quickly how we do this here. But there are at least 3 broad orienting questions that ethicists think about when we think about ecological or environmental issues on that. The first one is what I call, what's the shape or what's the extent of our moral community? Now, what do I mean by that? When something or some person or some being has moral status, it means they have value for their own sake. They have intrinsic value for their own sake, and that means they make claims on us. We can't treat them simply as property, simply as objects. We have to actually respect the value that they have as a moral being. And so I used the example yesterday to talk about how that has been expanding over time in human history. That initially, the moral community was probably the family. And so you had these recognized moral claims of anybody in your family, but anybody outside your family didn't. Although I will say, remind ourselves that even in that case, in patriarchal societies, women and children were viewed first as property and not as moral persons in their own right. And so you have many societies, for example, that would practice infanticide for good reasons ecologically to control property, but children were treated as property that you could be disposed of. Or wives could simply be divorced and sent away there. So it's been a long journey in the human community to expand the moral friendly. So now, as mentioned, in 1948, we passed the United Nations Declaration on Universal Rights, and now we recognize that by being human, you have moral standing. what's emerged in the last few decades is this question, do we need to expand that moral community beyond humans? That is, do animals, for example, have moral status? If so, which ones? Some people would say the dividing line is sentience, the ability to feel pleasure and pain. So animals that have a highly developed nervous system, such as pigs or dogs or cattle or chickens, that these all have to be considered for moral status, but we wouldn't have to necessarily think of an amoeba as having moral status, even though it's technically a creature. Other people have said, well, why divide that between animals and plant life? Shouldn't we think about the moral status? And increasingly, we're learning more and more about plants and trees and so forth that we simply haven't known. I just put that out there because that shapes the first debate. And what I say is there are endpoints on there, but most people fall somewhere in between. So the endpoint of this one is pure anthropocentrism. It says only human beings have moral status. Everything else we can treat as property, as a resource for our own use. And I would say that's been the dominant position in the Western tradition up until the last few centuries there. So one of the thinkers, and I'm digressing a little too much here, but this is the tendency, we try to give a mini class in a single lecture. So last week when I was doing the geology of the Pacific Northwest, I gave an entire class on geology so that we could understand our geology here. But in this one here, one of the most important philosophers in the Western tradition was René Descartes. Some of you may have read him in your university studies. And René Descartes was a strong dualist. He separated our material reality from our mental capacities. And he said what gave a person, and Immanuel Kant, if any of you read Kantian ethics, followed Descartes in this sense. He said what gives a person moral status is the ability to be rational, to make rational choices and rational decisions. Well, that, of course, rules out almost all of the rest of the animal world that are not rational in the same way that we are here. But that's been the dominant tradition in the West. And so Descartes, for example, after Descartes, there was the whole practice of vivisection, of cutting animals open while they were alive in order to study them, became a strong thing. And they appealed to Descartes, who said because they don't have rational souls, they can't really feel pain. He said that when you hear a dog screaming or crying when you're cutting open, it's like a squeaky wheel. You know, just ignore it. I mean, to us today, it seems really appalling. And that's because I think most of us have moved away from pure anthropocentrism. We're somewhere on this spectrum. The other side of the spectrum is what folks in deep ecology talk about, and they talk about that as a mouthful, but biological egalitarianism. And what that means is that anything that is alive has full intrinsic value, and we need to treat it that way. And that was the position I was kind of arguing over here, that everything has full and equal value. Most of us, some do, but most of us would probably not go that far. We would recognize a moral distinction, for example, between a human being and a plant, or maybe even between a human being and a chicken. So we might recognize that the chicken has value, but not the same value as a human being. And we would give reasons for that. Some people say that because human beings have moral capacity, we can think about morality, and we have rational abilities, that those give us more value. Others disagree with that. But that's the first distinction there, and it really shapes a lot about how we think about things. So when we'll be looking, for example, animal rights issues. Animal rights people tend to be strong in the biocentric argument, so the animals themselves have intrinsic value, they make moral claims on us, have to be respected. So we spent some time looking at discussion on that. A second debate that has shaped a lot of our political tradition in the West is where should our primary moral concern be focused? Should it be focused at the level of the individual, or should it be focused at the level of the community? And we've seen this largely again in anthropocentric or human-centered debates. So our society, the United States, has put a strong focus on individual rights. And so we have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution that guarantees our individual rights. We haven't recognized at a constitutional level the rights of the community, the whole community, the well-being. Socialist and communist countries tend to focus more on the whole well-being is set what's determined, and individuals are expected to accommodate to that. And then you have folks like social democracies, the Scandinavian countries, that would be somewhere in between on that. Libertarians, strongly on the individual side here. Communitarians, more on this side here. Well, when you bring that same debate into an ecological realm, then we start thinking about whether or not we're looking at the individual, more concerned for individual creatures, both human but also other kind or more than human creatures on that, so animal rights will come in here. But other people say, no, the really important thing are ecosystems. This is the community level, that without healthy functioning ecosystems, individuals can't flourish. So you have to focus primarily on the well-being of our ecosystems, and then individuals can have the basis for flourishing on that. So those are the two ones we did yesterday. The third one I want to start with today is my sister Martha and I are going to read this here, and I'd like to get some people, anybody who wasn't here yesterday, and that yesterday we did the first ring and the second ring, and I don't know if people are sitting in the same place in there, but if people who are in the third ring, or anybody who wasn't here who want to come, we'll get about 8 or 10 folks up here. What we're going to do is my sister Martha and I are going to have a hypothetical conversation. And this is a debate about where we should put our energies. One of that's going to debate about whether we should work within our systems and our cultures as we have them, or are those systems themselves part of the problem and need to be transformed and changed. And so we're going to carry out a little discussion on this. And then what I want to do, once we have these three in place, we're going to begin to look at how we're going to apply those to particular issues on that. Although I'm going to have to do one intermediate step today. So does that make sense, folks, here? So Martha, if you will, you got our, you got yours?
This is one.
Okay. Yes, and so, yeah, I'm going to have you stand over again over here, and I'll be over here. All right, so third ring folks who are there and want to come up forward here, we're just going to get you up in the middle here. Travis, were you here yesterday? Why don't you come up? Anybody in this room, again, you don't have to roll things, you just have to listen and think. And that includes pretty much everybody here.
It might be role playing for me.
If you weren't here yesterday, if you weren't here yesterday and didn't get to participate, feel free to come forward. All right, I think good. Anita will be here, but good thing here. So, your instructions here, Martha and I are going to lead a hypothetical conversation. I want you to listen to the arguments we're making. If you agree with that position, move towards it. If you disagree, you can either stay put or move away from it. We're going to go through several different ones. You have a chance to figure out where you are on the spectrum. For people who are not standing up here, I want you to be thinking about where you would be and why. And listen to the arguments that are made here and find out what you agree or disagree with and the reasons there. Martha, let's face it. The world is a mess. It seems the more we try to solve things, the more we mess things up. What we need is a completely different understanding of our relationship to and our place in the natural world. We will not be able to change our ecological problems until we transform ourselves, our cultures, in our societies. And you're going to be able to move several times, so don't feel like you can say, no. All right, so Martha, you've got your work cut out for you.
Oh, I'm feeling lonely again. Yes, Dan, we do need to be more careful and intelligent about our relationship to the rest of nature. But I don't think we need some profound change in our worldview or our philosophy to see what is wrong and take action. We can correct our environmentally harmful behavior by using better technologies, by updating our economic theories, and by passing better government regulations.
It has not worked.
Not at holding.
Martha, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we shouldn't take action where we can. But even these actions will inevitably be flawed until we change some of our basic assumptions about our relationship to the world. For example, we need to get rid of our false ways of thinking that see humans as separate from the rest of nature. We need to get rid of our false sense of thinking that we're independent from the laws of nature and accept our true interdependence with all other forms of life.
It is true that our narrow human-centered ways of thinking have caused enormous harm. We are deeply indebted to people like you who stress the interdependence of all forms of life. I think we are beginning to understand how we as human beings are dependent on other forms of life and how we need to take care of them in order for all of us to live. It's clear that we need to reform our ways of living to be better stewards of the earth than we have been.
Well, excuse me, Martha. I love saying that. This is my younger sister who used to pick on me so much as a kid, so now I have to take advantage of that. Excuse me, Martha, but your stewardship model assumes precisely the paternalistic attitude that I'm talking about. It flows out of an up-down, dualistic mindset that always has someone or something on top of somebody or something else managing and controlling things for the good of those underneath. Historically, that's meant men in charge of women, one race in charge of another, owners in charge of workers. The only difference here is it's humans on top of the rest of nature. I think that this top-down attitude is the underlying root of not only the eco-crisis, but also racism, sexism, and class exploitation. Until we demolish this way of thinking and acting, all our efforts will only exacerbate the ecological crisis.
Whoa, Dan, that was a fast jump from stewardship to patriarchy. The point is that we have to be realistic about what we can change. We don't have a lot of time for philosophical introspection and creating the new culture you desire. Unless we act quickly and wisely in the next 10 to 20 years, the ecological systems that support life on Earth will collapse. We don't have the luxury to spend much time reflecting on how we got to this mess. We need to direct our energies towards how we can get out of it. We can't simply go back to some earlier, simpler time. The world is too complex for that. For better or worse, given the enormity of the problems that face us, this means working within the system we already have in place and using the technology and political power already available to us.
Yeah.
Hang in there, Anita.
Martha, everybody agrees that we have to act now, immediately. But working within the system is no long-term answer. The system itself is the problem. It's what caused our current problems. We might be able to limit some of the damage in the short term by working within the system, but the only effective long-term solution will require a total transformation of both the system and the culture that supports it. We need to adapt our societies and economies to the ecosystems and ecological constraints where they're found, and not continue to try to force nature to adapt to us.
Yeah. I just don't see doing
what's
that.
What's the matter with you, Darius?
Well, Dan, I think you are too pessimistic about our abilities to change our behavior and our culture. Reform of the system is possible. Just look at the significant accomplishments of environmental legislation in the U.S. over the last 30 years, such as the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. Transformation of human beings and social systems is possible, but it takes place one step at a time. It is better to take concrete steps to reform our current system than to focus on unrealistic utopias for the future.
Yeah. All right, we got a pretty good spread. We have people who move back and forth quite a bit. So like we did yesterday, I want to start with people who are on the end points, and then we'll move in towards the center there. So we got a couple people over, well, actually a cluster of people who moved over towards Martha there. Tell us what was either compelling about her position or problematic with mine.
Well, for me, what's compelling about her position is that even though
there is a sense of a patriarchal system here. Nevertheless, we are the ones who have the ability to do something about it.
All right. Anybody else over there want to talk about why you're where you are?
I think need a lot more Indians and chiefs to do and get busy doing things is real important. Too many people talking about it gets nothing done.
Yeah. Okay.
I look at what technology has done so far, you know, from cleaning up cars and the pollution problem that we used to have, and, you know.
That's true.
And so I'm hopeful that technology can help us in the future, too.
And I have seen that people's attitudes do change as along with the technology. Now, things have happened. We feel very differently than we did 50 years ago about the Earth.
So there's cultural change happening.
And it's absolutely true that we can't waste too much energy on the underneath and still put energy into the getting it done now.
All right. Let's come over to this side here. We had a few of you who came over. It's pretty good stayed over here. Move back and forth a little bit, but mostly stayed over here. Why are you over on this side?
I'm not at the end of the patriarchy. Let me start there. And I see how many men in a row before we move. A better chance of revamping all the systems here than we do starting all new systems on a very uninhabitable planet, Mars. So I'm here.
So you're not for terraforming Mars?
I am not. And I'm more of a both and person, but I have a point to make too.
I would agree with that statement about our living on this planet has to be within the ecological limits. And so, like, how are we going to argue about that? You know, those are the limits.
Yeah, I keep being, like, pulled back and forth, but not all the way. Because I think, despite significant changes in technology and policy, that, like, any beginner's look at the ecological crisis has shown that it's just gotten worse and worse and worse despite those gains. So I see the arguments, but I struggle to be pulled all the way.
All right, and then we got, you are immediately right over here with me, and then move back over towards the center. We've got a few folks who are more in the center here. What's going on?
I think attitude is so much of it, and so many people are currently under the fake news or the climate change deniers. There's so many people out there who don't believe that our environment really matters. And I know some of those people personally. They exist. They're real. They're out there. And until you can change the, you know, underlying philosophies, people aren't going to care. Just like anything else, they're not going to change their opinion about gay marriage until they realize, oh, they love people who are gay, and they're, you know, it's like you need to change your emotional outlook on things. But yes, things have changed for the better in some cases, but I see a lot of that stuff being flipped in the last few months, and people are going to step backwards quite a bit, and we're going to run out of time.
I want you to know that there's a gap here. So I'm still leaning this direction, but I think that you stated a vision. You stated that which we could draw us to our better selves. And you were stating, come on, let's get on with it. We don't have the time. We have to act on something. And I'm like Bonhoeffer, do what is right and just. Do not be swayed by the whim of the moment. So, that's why I'm over here.
You know, this is like an incredibly articulate group of folks. I want to just videotape you all and show you to my students. They are also really wonderful. But I'm really impressed with the ability of people to think. You've thought about these issues. And Martha's position is much more the position of environmental pragmatism. It says, look, you know, we've got urgent issues. Let's be pragmatic. Let's take what we have. Let's do the good technology we have. Let's do better legislation. Let's rethink the way we're doing our economies. But let's take what we have and work with it. And mine is the position that says, look, what we have is what's got us into the problem in the first place. You know, one of the problems we have is we have a market-based economy that's dependent on continual growth. Capitalism requires growth. We have a planet that can't grow. At a certain point, we run into real ecological constraints that simply can't be surpassed. So until we begin to recognize that and begin to adapt our way of living to ecological constraints, all the other small steps are simply going to get us in the problem there. I'm going to let folks sit down here. And yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, anyway, I was really impressed that both of you are really on a left side of the spectrum. That there's a heck of a lot of the country and the world that are way over there
You really anticipate a wonderful point. Thank you, which I'm going to put on the board here. But then your name is
Ann.
Ann, I'm going to call this the Ann point here.
So Dan and Martha, tell us where you would have stood.
Well, so this is always interesting. Where would we have stood? Let me make one other point here, and then I'm going to get Ann point on the board here. This is a question about vision. And it partly depends on whether you think this is the current situation. I'm on a train. I can see trouble ahead. I better get the train to go over this way to avoid the trouble. Or, I'm on a train. I can see trouble ahead. I better get off the train. All right, the train is going to go, whether it veers off one way or the other, train's going over the cliff. I got to reverse it and get off. And that's a difference in vision here. But Anne made a really important point, which is I actually put 3 points on this part of here. There's a whole nother level there, which I would call is simply the status quo, that simply denies that there are any problems with our current situation here. Then you have folks who say, no, I can recognize there are problems. We need to address those problems. We can do that by reforming our system here. Better technologies, better economic theories, better legislation, but the system itself is pretty good, but we can reform it. And then there are the folks on the overcharged position I talked about here, which there are many different ones, but they get grouped together in a group called radical ecology. And radical in this sense comes from the Latin word radix, where we get our word radish from. It means roots. It means you've got to get to the root of the problem there, and we can't simply deal with the symptoms. And you'll find environmental folks in quite a few different places on this here. And sometimes, what I like about this, when I work with my students here, I'll give you one example that I hope will begin to illustrate this, because we're going to start teasing out different perspectives on this. I want you to think for a minute. We talked a little bit of this last time. I talked to some of you about two groups of people who are deeply concerned about animals. Okay? One is the Animal Liberation Front, and the other is the Humane Society. Okay? Now, are folks familiar with the Animal Liberation Front? I mean, they really want to liberate animals, so they take a position that animals should not be eaten, raised for feed. We should not be wearing them. We should not be testing medical things or perfumes on them. That animals are moral beings, and we cannot violate their integrity. Okay? And then there are the Humane Society that also says animals have moral sense. We need to treat them humanely, treat them well. But let's think about this. So on the first spectrum between anthropocentrism and biocentrism, where would you put the Animal Liberation Front? Way over here on biocentrism, okay? How about the Humane Society? Yeah, they're close to biocentrism, but they're a little bit over here. Which of these groups, do they focus on the individual animals and treating them well? Do they focus on whole ecosystems? Both of these groups focus strongly on individual animals. So the Humane Society and the Animal Liberation Front both would be strongly over here, all right? Focusing on the moral worth of individual animals. But I think the third place is where they really begin to divide, okay? Animal Liberation Front. If we took seriously their claim that we cannot use animals for eating, for wearing, for medical testing, for testing any sort of this, we cannot use animals as a means to our ends there. What would our society look like? It would have to be a radical change. So ALF is looking for a radical transformation of society. How about the Humane Society? Humane Society is certainly not status quo. They're very unhappy here, but they're probably looking much more at reform. And there, we can treat animals better, but they don't go the full over there. So what you begin to see is you can find out, and sometimes when you do this kind of mapping, where the groups have areas in common and work together, but more importantly, sometimes showing us where they have differences and why, for example, some people will support the Humane Society but wouldn't support a radical group like Animal Liberation Front. They think it goes too far. Or conversely, while people would say, no, we really need to change the whole system, and the Humane Society is too moderate for that. So we can see this in lots of different groups. Yes, Anne.
I actually volunteer for the Austin Humane Society.
Oh.
I foster kittens. And what I've discovered is, like, if we have get-togethers, they're almost all vegetarian. Mm-hmm. It's just a complete coincidence, it seems, but they're almost more towards the ALF
Well, what begins to happen, I think, is when you start taking biocentrism and individual concern seriously, then you begin to question your own habits on this here. And so, I mean, I'll do a moment of true confession here. I lived in Iowa for 10 years, and I taught at Drake University. And when I got to Iowa, it really opened my eyes to the animal industry there. And we're going to do a case on Thursday that looks at here, and I'm not trying to implicate anybody, but it was 5:30 every night, Iowa Public Radio did the slaughter reports. And I just never lived any place in that. And it made total sense, but I couldn't believe the numbers. I mean, say, today, 400,000 cattle were killed, 550,000 sheep, or hogs, and 150,000 sheep. That was just today. And the next day, that thing happened. The next day happened, and I realized in Iowa, about 20 to 22 million hogs are killed every year. They're raised largely in factory farm conditions, and it was all happening around me, and I was simply, it was hidden. I never saw it. And so I realized, sort of said, there's this animal genocide going on all around me, and I'm participating in it. So I became a really strong vegetarian. Then I moved to Montana 17 years ago, and I met this wonderful man who was here last week, and he had not one but two mooses in the freezer. He was a hunter. And I met all these environmentalists who were hunters, and they'd see hunting as a really important part about keeping ecosystems healthy and balanced. So without them, we get overrun by deer, animals, things like that. And so they had a very different perspective. And I hadn't met many environmentalists who were also hunters. And so I kind of shifted. Now I'm a, here's another mouthful, I'm a bioregional flexitarian. Which means I'm a mostly vegetarian, but if I'm, well, Martha will remember this one story I'll tell you about my family, but if the animal lived in my bioregion, had a good quality of life, and it's part of the ecological well-being, you know, so we have grass-fed cattle, we have free-range chickens, there's other things, so, and I do eat eggs a lot, and so it's just thinking of that. I have to tell you one funny story about that, which is a little bit of a digression, but I also, for a long time, I had what I call kind of a Buddhist hospitality ethic. And which is Buddhist monks, most of them are vegetarian by nature, but they also live by begging or by asking things, and they typically will not turn down food to someone else, even if it has animal products in it, they will still eat that because it's part of that hospitality ethic there. So I made the mistake one time because my mother was very concerned that I was going to die imminently by being vegetarian. And I just know she was a physician and didn't think I could meet my nutrition needs like that. And I made the mistake of saying, well, Mom, I do eat some animals. And I have this Buddhist philosophy. And she remember this, Martha. She called up all my siblings and said, whenever Danny comes over to visit you, feed him meat. If you serve it to him, he can't say no. And I said, Mom, that really kind of defeats the purpose here. But the point that you're making, Anne, is that, you know, what tends to happen, it's not surprising me at all that people who work at the animal with Humane Society, they may not go so far. For example, one of the places that are really challenging for me is medical testing. You know, there are certain things in terms of really needing well-being for human beings that may require animal testing on that. But there's a lot of things that don't. Testing perfumes. I mean, we have all sorts of animal products that we test on animals. And so they'll take rabbits and they'll slit their eyes open and they'll put eyeliner in it to see how we react to it. Because they want to know what's going to happen to humans. And for most of this is all hidden from sight. But the point is, once you start raising these issues, then we become more aware of our own individual practices, and we have to start rethinking them. Yes, here.
So as we, as a nation, and as individuals, move away from an agrarian life and into the city, I mean, we sterilize everything. We sterilize death. We sterilize where our meat comes from. If you've ever lived on a farm and harvested the animal, you have a much bigger appreciation. Yeah. For what's on your plate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whether that's your mother sending you to the garden with a salt shaker and a knife, or your father sending you out to harvest what's for dinner.
Yeah.
And we, because we're so, we don't think about where that animal has been or comes from,
yeah.
Or where our food source and what's being put on that food source. I live in Austin. We think about those things because we're in Austin.
Because you're in Austin.
It's part of our culture.
And I'm in Missoula, the same thing. Okay. University towns.
So there's little
pockets yeah. where we are thinking about that. But
well, you make a really important point, which is the vast majority of us interact with animals primarily on our plates, other than our pets, our companion animals. And we make a moral separation between our companion animals. Most of us would not think about eating or doing testing on our dogs. But hogs, who are at least as cognitively intelligent, at least as sentient there, most of us don't think twice about. We don't have that direct, because we used to be agrarian or hunter-gatherer. And both of those societies interact with animals regularly, and they had whole ritualistic ways of dealing with it. Thanksgiving prayers, sacrifice prayers, awareness of that. Most of us are separate from that. We're desensitized. And so that's part of what ethics is trying to do, is to bring these to life so we can think about them together there and make informed choices on that. And this is where people who are more on the radical side say, it's not coincidental. I mean, I'm not going to pick on Iowa here, because I had a really wonderful experience of Iowa, but in Iowa, it's illegal to go in and film practices in these factory farms. Because they understand, if people saw the way animals were treated on these places, they would change their minds. But it's against the law to do that. You can be prosecuted for filming that. And so we have a whole system that shields it. This is just one example. We can do all sorts of different examples. I mean, if you begin to investigate how our clothing is made, which we have another case in the book here called Wearing Injustice, the whole way of clothing and the environmental impact of modern clothing. And so almost every aspect of our life gets implicated somehow in these areas there. And it points to the systemic nature of modern life. Very few of us choose the economic systems, the pollutions that we live in. We just simply are born into them. So I was born into capitalism. I wasn't born into a medieval worldview with knights and kings and nobles and things like that. I wasn't born into an agrarian society. I wasn't born into a hunter-gatherer society. So we have these systems. So then how do we think thoughtfully about them and both make individual choices but also work for systemic change? And that's where a lot of this is going on here. But then, as Anne pointed out, I'm sorry to keep picking on you, Anne, but now that I know your name, it's very convenient. I would say that our dominant system right now, particularly in the light of the recent elections in terms of environmental issues, is right on this side here.
Yep.
It's completely human-centered. It's focusing on individual rights, particularly property rights. That's the way this translates oftentimes, is that when we have the right to do whatever we want with our property. And it's perfectly happy with the status quo. We put in our current Secretary of the Environmental, what is the EPA? The Environmental Protection Agency. I apologize, I started calling it the Environmental Predation Agency. Because the current head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, was the Attorney General in Oklahoma and works very closely with the fossil fuel industry to roll back any of the reforms that have been put in place there. There's a hand here, yeah.
Yeah, and there lies the problem, what Kurt said over there. The laws could be changed back, and that's what's, I think, happening.
We're seeing some rollback in here. So I would say, you know, that the Obama administration was probably sort of more along here. Anytime, I mean, we have to understand, our economic and political system is strongly on this side. Yeah. Our Constitution deals only with human beings. It deals primarily with individual rights. And because it's in our system, it's the status quo. So anything that any government agency is going to work largely within this world, but it can move things a little bit in this direction. What you begin to see is citizen movements, nonprofit groups, churches, faith communities, so that oftentimes are moving more in this direction, and then they're pressuring the government to move this direction here. But, you know, and what I see a lot of times, since I teach in environmental studies, a lot of my students, their own convictions are much more over on this side. They really want to see a transformation things. They want to see ecological things. But they work in systems that are embedded over here. And so it was almost always a built-in tension, a built-in frustration. And Martha, I imagine my sister Martha worked in county government for years. Her husband is manages wildlife refuge for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife System. You're embedded in systems that may or may not have the same values that you share personally, and you have to work within that realm. And that's true for many of us. You know, if you're a pastor, you're embedded in an institutional church, and you're going to sometimes have friction with what that church stands for and what you personally believe. But it really comes out a lot in the environment here. So what I'd like to do now, was that, Monica, did you have your hand up? Or?
Well, I was just thinking, it's interesting, it's kind of funny in a way, but when Trump won, when Trump won, my first reaction was, okay, I'm not eating meat anymore. It's like a visceral thing, because I think on some deeper level, I recognize that he's the extreme of that system, and I think I know a lot of people, and there may be some good to, not a lot of good, but some good to him having won, in the sense that we're all now having to be completely honest with being part of that system on that side.
There are many, many people who are more on the left, got very complacent during the Obama years. I mean, there's some really interesting ironies we could talk about in here. Donations to environmental groups are through the ceiling right now. ACLU, flushing. I mean, all of us are real concerned with that. Do you know what has plummeted since the Trump administration took place? Gun sales. Gun sales are way down. All right. Irony, because they know they have someone in there who works closer to the NRA. Every time Obama got reelected, anytime he did anything, gun sales went through the ceiling. So we've got these ironies. You know, the Trump administration has been really good for environmental movement, environmental activism at that level, but at the institutional level, it's really problematic because they have a lot of power to implement the changes, which, you know, President Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Accords, he's withdrawn, reversed the Obama Clean Power Plan. So we see these tensions here. I'll take one more comment here, and then I want to move us to one other thing here.
Just address for a moment the reality of our Supreme Court deciding that corporations have the rights and moral concern of individuals.
Yeah. Well, it's a really challenging issue. And this is a Supreme Court decision that actually dates back to the 1800s. So we've inherited here, but it's been really revitalized. The Supreme Court has ruled that corporations have the legal status of persons. And it's called a legal fiction. That's the actual legal term for it. But it means, and there's some benefits. It means corporations can sue and be sued. They can be held accountable, things like that. But it also has given corporations tremendous power. And I think the most recent one we're seeing now is because corporations are recognized as persons, and persons under our Bill of Rights have protection of free speech, that now the Supreme Court has equated money and corporate donations with free speech that has to be protected. And Citizens United is the one that did that here. Yeah. And so corporations have the protection of individuals, but corporations don't really have the same moral capability as most individuals. And there's just all sorts of reasons about this. Your corporations operate under a whole different set of assumptions and values and practices, but they have the protections now in place. And so it's meant that we now live in a world where corporations have just enormous influence on that, and it's protected constitutionally.
No.
Yeah, and it makes a big challenge when you talk about these environmental issues. Now, but we're going to get to that. I want to do one other set of exercise here, and I don't want to leave the people in the balcony out, although I know sometimes people sit in the balcony because you want to be left out. So I've been a balcony sitter before as well. I want to do, we're going to try a six-way conversation. So I need five people who have been readers, and I want to invite, if there are any people in the balcony who would be willing to come downstairs and be a reader in this exercise. And if you want to stay up there, that's perfectly fine. We got John there.
Put the ladder up.
If you're willing to be a reader, come downstairs here. This is going to be a little challenging because we have this beautiful rock centerpiece here, but we're going to put six different positions around the room. Mark and I will do two, and I'll need four of the readers here. And we're going to have a little conversation, the same way we did in here. I want you to stay seated for the first time. We're going to go around there, listen to the conversations, and then if you're physically mobile and want to, if you don't want to get up, that's perfectly fine. Perfect. We got four readers right there. That's great. Then I want you to go and stand in the part of the room that you think is closest to your own viewpoint on that. Then we'll have one more round of conversations, and we'll see where people are standing and talk about why. Then I'll do my little show here on that. So let's get this going here. It's here. So John, you'll stand there. John, if you go stand over that corner there, and.
Hi, Juliana.
Juliana, if you would sort of stand sort of under the projector over there, and Josh, if you stand over that corner there, we've got two Joshes here. Okay. So again,
so
You should have a highlighted, each of you should have a highlighted sheet, and then there's a second position on the back side. So we'll start off here. I'll read my position, pause and think about it, and let Martha read hers, and we'll just go around the room. Think about the different positions, about which one's closest to you. Then we'll get a chance to mix everybody up and try that out, and then we'll do it again. As someone concerned about the environment, I think the best way to protect nature is through property rights and markets. Nature provides us with valuable natural resources that must be used efficiently. Allocating natural resources through the free market and respecting property rights is the best way to do that.
I agree that we must use our natural resources wisely, but relying on the marketplace alone to do that will only result in greater exploitation of nature. Rather, we need wise government policies informed by the principles of scientific management and ecology to conserve nature so that it can be a sustainable source of resources for us and for future generations.
Both of you see nature as a source for humans, looking at nature only for its instrumental value for our use. But much of the natural world has intrinsic value, even sacred value, that we need to recognize, respect, and preserve. Some places are too valuable in and of themselves for development, and instead should be protected and preserved for their own sake, and the plants and animals that live within them.
You are right that we need to recognize the intrinsic value of sacred places and preserve them. But we need to do so much more. The key point is that all life on Earth has value for its own sake, independent of their usefulness for humans. Present human interference with the non-human world is excessive and getting worse. We need a substantial decrease in human impacts on nature, and that implies a decrease in the global human population.
The key to resolving environmental issues is recognizing the disproportionate impact environmental problems have on the poor and communities of color. We need to integrate social justice and environmental concerns into an ethic of environmental justice. The environment is not just wild places and wilderness, but also where we live, work, play, and pray. And we need to make sure that it is a livable environment for all people.
The key to resolving environmental issues is to realize they are always also ecological issues. We need to develop an ecological perspective and set of practices to resolve these issues. Rather than focusing on preserving some places as sacred or wild, or on conserving nature for the resources it can provide, we should focus on restoring ecological integrity to every place we inhabit. The fields of ecological restoration and agroecology offer promising ways to address environmental concerns by putting ecological integrity first in how we inhabit the land.
Those are your six choices. Thanks a lot. So if you can go stand wherever you think you're closest or between positions you think, and again, if you don't want to move around, you're welcome to stay seated here. Bring all this good energy in again. Good initial distribution. Now we're going to go through one more so you can sort of hear again, and if you want to reshuffle yourself, you can on this here. Okay, all of you, that all sounds nice in theory. But we need environmental policies and practices that focus on results rather than rhetoric, and replace conflict with cooperation. Markets, property rights, and the rule of law are fundamental to economic growth, and economic growth is fundamental to improving environmental quality. Property rights make the environment an asset rather than a liability by giving owners an incentive for good stewardship. Markets based on respect for property rights allow people with different priorities regarding the use of natural resources to cooperate rather than fight. When cooperation supplants conflict, both society and the environment are better off.
But we need good governance to use natural resources fairly, equitably, and sustainably. Look at the 19th century. Letting the market and profit motive decide led to widespread deforestation and near extinction of many species. With conservation, resources in the public domain are used for the benefit of all people, not just the powerful. Government agencies accountable to elected officials administer sustainable use policies on behalf of all of us so that resources are not exhausted and are used sustainably. It's what Gifford Pinchot meant by a wise use policy.
The conservation policies you espouse are certainly better than using markets or reducing nature to property, but it's still too anthropocentric and utilitarian. But what we most need to protect is ecosystems, species, and wild animals from degrading human practices. John Muir understood the basic insights of ecology, that everything is hitched to everything else in the universe. Ecosystems are too complex to be managed successfully. We simply can't understand all the consequences of our actions. Preserving the integrity of natural places is the most effective way to conserve nature, not seeing nature as yet another thing to be managed for our benefit.
Well, that's a good start. But what we really need for long-term sustainability is a complete paradigm shift in how we see ourselves in relation to the rest of the world. The flourishing of human life and cultures is compatible with a substantial decrease in the human population, and the flourishing of non-human life requires such a decrease. I recognize that this decrease in population can't take place overnight, but we need to begin the cultural and policy shifts now to make it happen. We've already exceeded the carrying capacity of the planet.
The paradigm shift you call for will almost certainly be carried out at the expense of the already most vulnerable. It's deeply racist and classist. Instead, we need a fair distribution of environmental benefits and burdens so that all communities can thrive. We need to build a movement of all peoples of color to fight the destruction and taking of our lands and communities, such as the Lakota people have been doing at Standing Rock in opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. We need to reestablish our spiritual interdependence to the sacredness of Mother Earth. We need environmental justice and the right to ethical and responsible uses of land in the interests of a sustainable planet for humans and other living things.
With the insights of ecology and new appropriate technologies, we now have the ability to restore ecological integrity to nature and develop ecological sustainable ways of living. We can't avoid having an impact on our environments. All organisms affect their environment. But with ecological restoration, we can take responsibility for the past degradation we have caused to the land and learn how to live more sustainably. A big part of the negative impact we have caused the land has come from how we have raised food through an extractive, industrial-scale agriculture. Agroecology and the local food movement are showing us how we can live within the ecological constraints of the land and live better and more healthily.
Now, does anybody want to relocate yourself or shift at all? Are you all pretty much where you would be? Okay, so let's see if we can name these six positions here, and then we'll hear a little bit from each, some people who are in each position about why they're standing where they are. What would you name the position that I read?
Wrong.
We're going to do descriptive rather than evaluative naming here. Yeah, this is the free market position, all right? That we should let the market make decisions about environmental issues. The position that Martha read?
The governance.
Yeah, and it's a classic what we call conservation position here. That we should conserve nature as natural resources we need, and we need government management and science to know how to best do that. And as she read, there was a memo, Gifford Pinchot was the first director of the Forest Service and was really involved with Teddy Roosevelt and the conservation movement. How about the folks over here that were in John's position?
Nature Conservancy.
Protection.
Yeah, it's classically called the preservation movement. It was the Sierra Club and John Muir were the ones there who said that nature, many parts of nature are too valuable, too sacred, they should be preserved and protected. So the fact that we're in a wilderness setting, the Glacier Peak Wilderness is a good example of preserving and protecting that.
In some sense, that in wildness is the preservation of the world.
Yes, and who said that?
I Thoreau.
It's a wonder, that's Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. It's a wonderful thing. And I'm glad you actually quoted correctly. A lot of people quote that it is in wilderness is the preservation of the world, but he said in wildness. We need to preserve the wild in nature on that. Good. This position, no cost for me here.
Zero population.
Yeah, lower population.
Yeah, and the position itself is one that's oftentimes called deep ecology. Deep ecology has all sorts of other dimensions to it, but deep ecology would be strongly over here. Biocentric ecological holism, radical ecology, and particularly concerned that human population growth and consumption is harming the entire planet. We need a radical. And, well, I'll come back to that here, because it was very controversial because deep ecology, when it was first posited, anybody know what number they said that the good carrying capacity of the planet was for humans? About 100 million. Right? That's 1/75th of where we are today. So they were accused immediately of being, you know, misanthropes, and they said, look, we're not talking about doing this overnight. We're not talking about genocide. We're saying this is a goal we need to move to. Good human flourishing and the rest of the planetary flourishing are possible with that, but it's not possible with, at that point, it's like 4 or 5 billion. Now we're at 7.5 billion. Josh, one's position over here. Let me know what we...
Social justice.
Yeah, and it's called the environmental justice movement. And has very, very, very concerned that there's a disproportionate burden being placed on communities, poor communities, and communities of color with environmental problems and disproportionate access to the benefits of not getting those there. So we're very concerned about that. And then how about over here?
Eco-technology.
Yeah, it's kind of an ecological perspective. There were two things that we're citing there, ecological restoration, that we can actually now use good technologies to restore damaged ecosystems, something I'm very involved in. And the other was agroecology, that we can use the principles of ecology for the way we do agriculture, but developing an ecological mindset and kind of applying it to everything we have there. Yeah?
Is it possible to have a blend of all these?
Yes. So this is why, yes, and that's a really good point. What I had you read were endpoint perspectives. But it's quite possible to put yourself in being. So Travis, for example, I mean, I had Travis and Miller, initially stood right here, and then he moved to, I'm thinking he's from a program between me and Martha's position. There's several of you maybe in between. Some of you, if we had access, could be standing right in the middle here. But so yes, these are not mutually exclusive, although some are. I mean, for example, deep ecology and free market ecology are on opposite sides here, and there's a pretty big gulf between them.
Would they interrupt or interfere with each other? If someone took a stand one way, would it interfere with another one?
It's a really good question. What I want to do is let's just get a sampling of one or two people from each position about why you're standing where you are, so we get a sense of people can articulate where you are, and then we'll sit down, and if you got another 10, 15 minutes, I want to do one closing thing on that. Travis?
Yeah, so you probably find it really strange that the naturalist is standing closest to Dan. Like my initial response was I wanted to be kind of like the far corner of the room over there. But then I started taking a look at the actions that I actually employ, and I feel like that's inseparable from your ethic. And so I feel like I'm marching as hard as I can in this direction, but because of a lot of the systematic things that I'm in, it's difficult to actually say that my ethic is over there when many of my actions suggest that I'm more closer to this side of the spectrum.
And I raised that question yesterday about whether anybody in the room ever has a bit of a gap between what your values are and the way you actually live. And this is really challenging. And Travis makes a good point. We're embedded in systems that oftentimes make these decisions for us. We don't have much choice about that.
We heard that yesterday in that one movement that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're moving back and forth. Anybody standing over with Martha there, why are you close to that position?
I would just say that I've been involved in a community, and there's all these little groups doing their own thing.
And it's so scattered that it just seems like it can all come to the, you know, we all need to affect our government.
Yeah.
And if we can do that efficiently, we can make change happen with the system we have.
And this is the position of conservation. And this is, I would say, most of our government agencies, the Forest Service, the BLM, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, operate explicitly out of a conservation thing. Oftentimes it's a multiple use policy. You see our forests and our rivers as resources for multiple use. That can include recreation, it can include logging, it can include species preservation, but they all are part of conserving them for current and future benefit in there. Now, what we're seeing right now is that our current administration has appointed people who are solidly in my position to head those conservation agencies. So we're seeing internal strife within those agencies about there. So for example, we have a head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, who believes strongly in free market values, in the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. So he will use free market mechanisms to achieve environmental goals. But there are many career people in the EPA who disagree with him. And so there'll be some interesting internal struggles on that.
He does have goals, huh?
Yeah, and if you don't agree with them, they're pretty frightening, but they're clearly laid out. How about folks over here?
Well, I think what my perspective is, in the John Muir mode over here, I'm very passionate about the outdoors and preserving property for everyone to use, and it's really a objection of the free market agent area,
yeah,
where I think this is the most threatened part of our nation, in our country, and in the world of property with that free market. I could easily be in a lot of these other sections. Doesn't mean I don't agree with them.
But you see, this is the priority here. Well, let me give you an example of a current thing like that. My former congressperson from Montana, Ryan Zinke, is the new Secretary of the Interior. One of the very first actions that the Trump administration has done is ordered him to review all of the national monument designations of the last 25 years, which there are places that preserve spaces. That's a big thing to preserve. So Bears Ears National Monument is the most recent one, but there's lots and lots of other ones that have taken place in the last 25 years. And there has never been a president who has reversed a previous president's decision on that. We may see this being the first time to roll that back. And it's primarily because there are many people who are concerned they no longer have free market access to those places to develop those natural resources. So we're seeing these kind of philosophical tensions playing out in government policy right now. Anybody who was standing over here?
You chose me, so you go right ahead.
I could get my teeth on that overpopulation part of it, and I think, as we've said, there are too many people, and just in our own country, too many people use too many cars, big cars, overconsumption of gas. More people means we need more food, including animals. And I come from a town where animal is
big animal farm processing plant.
Well, let's see, I had another thought about that. Means more food is needed, and I understand that there is enough food in the world to feed everybody. It's just the distribution and getting it to the people, which means more fuel, fossil fuels.
Lots of transportation costs.
I've glommed onto the population.
All right. Then let's say one from each of the positions here. We'll wind it up. Yeah, Lily.
Rachel Carson had people listen to her, and instead of just banning DDT in the United States, banned it worldwide, right? There are many people in around the equator that suffer from malaria.
That's right.
And doctors there said the only thing we have is DDT. Mm-hmm. So if you ask a person of color in the middle latitudes about this, you know, they'd say, you're taking my children away from me because you took this chemical away to be like these guys. Mm-hmm. And now that thought popped into my head yesterday, but it makes me a zigzagger, you know.
Yeah.
You can't be any one of these completely because there's going to be exceptions.
Or people like me who are really excited about the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area, Glacier National Park, all these wonderful preservation places in John Muir, and completely neglect where Rebecca's living now, the inner city of New York, you know, that also has environmental challenges of asthma and youth and lead paint, all these other kinds of things. I so environmental justice was in a big corrective to that. And finally, folks over here.
Can I ask a question first?
Sure.
How is this group different from the Leaf Ecology group?
This is a group, for example, ecological restoration or agroecology, much, much more intervening in directly in the natural world using our technologies with ecological goals. I would put all three of these folks have ecological perspectives, but they do a different kind of sense on that. So deep ecology tends to be really let nature much more alone there and reduce human impacts on it here. This can be quite intensive in terms of its intervention, but with the goal is to increase ecological integrity. So what we see on the other side of Railroad Creek, you'd never see a deep ecologist doing that, I don't think. That's a good example of ecological remediation or things like that.
So once the damage is done, deep ecology says just leave it alone and let nature...
There are some ways that they would, but it's oftentimes it's get humans, just really reduce the human impact, and largely by getting human numbers down and human consumption down on that. And there, again, there are people, you know, there are crossovers between all these different things. Yeah.
I think I chose this one because so many of these things solve so many of the problems in the other.
Yeah.
Because agroecology helps people in third world countries and helps feed people. And ecological restoration can bring back areas that, I mean, it's not going to bring them back immediately. But, you know, I mean, cleaning up oil spills and going through and doing mine remediation and things like that.
This is, a lot of my students are drawn to this one here because it gives human beings a way to be active and positive in the environment. So many of the other places, like the preservation movement, see humans as always causing problems by our presence, or deep ecology. This is a way people feel like, well, we can take our abilities and use them constructively to improve things here. Yeah.
So it's also a perspective that says people are part of the
ecology. Are part, are integrated into it, exactly. What I'd like to do, and if anybody needs to leave right now, feel free to leave. I want to take five more minutes just to kind of synthesize this here. So people, if we want to have a seat and stay, just have a seat there. I'm just going to make one other point on this.
Would you be willing to tell us where you are in
what's a terrorist?
My students always ask me. I will, yes.
I'm still here.
So, it's not that there are not other perspectives, but what we just did was kind of six different perspectives. And what I want to show you a little bit is how these have emerged historically there, because I think it can help us understand a little bit about our tradition there. I'm gonna talk, I'm working the work of Jedediah Purdy, who teaches at Duke University. He says he calls these narratives of environmental imagination. The way we actually embed our ethics in the stories we tell about where we are. That's what I want to talk a little bit about. So I have a quote here, environmental imagination, how we see and how we learn to see, how we suppose the world works, how we suppose it matters, and what we feel we have a stake in. And we have a 200 plus year history in this country that predated by a couple hundred years of colonialism that have shaped the way we see the land in which we live and there. He says there are four main European American natives. First one is providential, right? That the Europeans settled this land as an act of God's providence. We created the earth, and then this is a gift that should be worked and transformed for human benefit. Probably our oldest narrative, still very powerful. Then there's what he calls the romantic and the preservation one. This really dates to Thoreau and John Muir and so forth. Recognizing nature had a value in its own things. We could see nature as what they call secular cathedrals. You look at Half Dome in Yosemite and see that there. There's a spiritual dimension of the natural world that needs to be recognized, preserved, and protected. Simultaneously was the conservation movement, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Says nature is really required as a resource for progress. We can build progress, but it needs wise management. It needs careful scientific planning on that. And the most recent one, and somebody, and Willie mentioned Rachel Carson here, but Aldo Leopold, Rachel Carson, folks like that, have tried to develop an ecological perspective. That nature is complex, it's interpenetrating, it's these interdependent systems, and humans are part of this. And it's kind of a worldview. So let me just go through these fairly quickly here, and we'll get off to lunch here. I wanted to bring this one up here because I think this painting is so amazing. I spent some time with my students on this here. But the providential view sees nature as a gift of God's providence. And then we actually have a duty to transform nature to make it productive. This, I would say, was the American pioneer ethic, the American settler ethic, that notion there. It culminated in a doctrine that was called Manifest Destiny, that the continent was given to the European settlers from sea to shining sea on that. The government's role in this is to facilitate the clearing, the settling, and the planting of the continent. All right, so we have the Homestead Act. We have all these things, the government's supporting the railroad development to move people all across the continent to settle and transform it there. This is a picture, a painting from 1872 called American Progress. And it's just she represents the spirit of progress. And what you see is the dark clouds over wilderness. The buffalo are fleeing, Native Americans are fleeing, the grizzly bear is fleeing. As progress moves across the continent, first with the covered wagons, the Pony Express, then you have the settlers starting to come in with their oxen, they're beginning to transform the land and plow it up. She is stringing the telegraph wires across the nation. There's the Wells Fargo cover wagon. The railroads are coming in behind, and over here you see civilization under the bright light of there. So it's a whole worldview that has a very, very strong shaping of our ethic, and I think it's still very much there. I would say this is probably still very dominant, for example, in the Trump administration, that we should be developing our resources. Or when people oppose wilderness designation, oftentimes they say we shouldn't be locking up our resources, we need to be using them. So the providential, and oftentimes explicitly backed up with a theological argument, for example, dominion, that we're given dominion over the planet on that. In contrast, the first protest movement against this was the Romantic movement from Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, John Muir, where they flipped from seeing nature as threat that needs to be transformed to nature as spiritual and beautiful in its own right and needs to be protected. So we begin to see the value of wild nature, and oftentimes seen as an antidote to civilization. Now civilization is not seen so much as the culmination, but civilization often is what corrupts us. And we need to get away sometimes from civilization, go to Holden Village for a week, turn off your cell phones, get purified, then you can go back and face the corrupt world and not be little caricatures. But I think a lot of us can recognize this. And the whole American National Parks movement, wilderness movement, going camping to get back to nature, Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, all this thing brought up this kind of spirit of meaning preserve nature because nature now is good. So the government role now is to preserve and protect nature from corrupting civilization. At the same time, there was a big split in the environmental movement around this is the conservation movement. This is Gifford Pinchot. His quote here, conservation is the foresighted utilization, preservation, or renewal of forests, waters, lands, and minerals for the greatest good of the greatest number for the longest time. That's the principle of what we call utilitarianism. You utilize things for the greatest good, for the greatest number, and he had it for the longest period of time. He built in sustainability to this. It was a response to widespread 19th century degradation of nature, the near extinction of the bison, the cutting of the forest, and so forth. Spearheaded a lot by Teddy Roosevelt. He named Gifford Pinchot the head of the Forest Service. Nature now is seen as a storehouse of resources, but they're not inexhaustible. They require careful and wise management on that. So this notion of utilitarian sustainability, the greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time, it's informed by ecology, but it's ecology to help us manage these resources. So most of our government agencies operate under this ethos or this story here. And the most recent one, I would say, is the ecological, which is actually, there's lots of different ones that are emerging there. Rachel Carson's book, Planet Spring, was a big thing on this. Aldo Leopold's book, Sand County Almanac, which Peter led some folks to yesterday, wasn't well known when it came out in 1948, but since that time, it's been kind of a Bible of this movement here, and here's Aldo Leopold himself. This is a place that says humans are always embedded in ecosystems, and ecosystems themselves are embedded in the planetary, you know, as you see climate, things like that. So we have to rethink how we understand our place in the broader set of ecosystems in the planet itself there. Really informed by ecology and science and a worldview, but so this notion that humans are fully interdependent with, dependent on natural ecosystems there, but also has a real spiritual dimension to it as well. A strong emphasis that the economy is always a subset of ecology. We've tended to do that the other way around. We've said the economy is first, and then nature provides resources for it. This says no, the ecology, ecosystem sits there, and our economy needs to fit into that. So we need regulations that operate at the level of systems. So our Clean Air Act is the atmospheric, our Clean Water Act is the water system, the Endangered Species Act. These operate at systems levels, sometimes well, sometimes not so well, but there's an awareness of the interdependency of things on that here. And so the role of government is to provide environmental law and regulation to protect ecosystems and the services we get from them on that. Within the ecological perspective, and I'm not gonna go through these time because of time, but we have the three different dimensions in them: the deep ecology perspective, environmental justice, which really looks at the social justice aspects of this, and the ecological restoration. And all I would say is all of these ecological ones, if I had this down in front of here, they're all tend to be mostly on this side. I'm the Vanna White now. This side of the spectrum here, biocentric, ecological, and looking for a real transformation of our system on that. So thank you for bearing with me. I wanted to get that out today. We'll start looking at the cases tomorrow. If you think you're going to come back tomorrow, I'll be back at 11 a.m. And you have time to read for 10 or 15 minutes. I have 30 copies of the case here. You're welcome to take one. If you're part of a couple, take one for the couple. And then there are also, if you want to read the commentary, those are also in the library. There's 5 copies in there. And if you don't have time to read them, don't still come back. We'll make do for that here, but it'll get you a little orientation. So thanks again for the day today.